All right, we're underway on session 52, lesson 9, page 56 in your outline. All righty, let's do a quick review where we were last week. Last week, Yeshua went from Bethany beyond the Jordan. Bethany beyond the Jordan is in Perea. And remember, Perea is an area of Jewish settlement to the east of the Jordan River. He went from Bethany beyond the Jordan, or basically somewhere in Perea, over to Bethany near Jerusalem. So remember, there's two Bethanies involved in this story. So he goes up the Jericho-Jerusalem road to Bethany. And here was that picture of Bethany in the 1800s. Probably looks very much like it did when he visited there. This is the second time it's recorded that he visited there in Bethany with Mary and Martha and Lazarus. But this time, Lazarus is dead. And Jesus made sure that he stayed away long enough for Lazarus to die. So when he gets there, Mary and Martha, the Greek text said, are wailing and sobbing in typical Middle Eastern fashion, just like these ladies are wailing at a funeral. But how does Yeshua weep? The Greek text says Jesus wept, shortest verse in the Bible. But his weeping is quiet. It's not overly emotional the way the other ladies are. Now, he wasn't weeping for Lazarus because he knew that he would raise Lazarus in just 2 minutes. You know, he'd say, Lazarus, come forth. He was weeping over the agony that sin and death brings to his creation. I think that's what he was weeping over. Agony that it brings to people he loves. So anyway, they made it to the tomb, and here's that watercolorized picture of the tomb in the 1800s. And he said, Lazarus, come forth, and Lazarus came forth from the grave, and therefore became the first instance of the sign of Jonah, the sign of resurrection. Remember, Jesus has been promising the nation since Matthew chapter 12. The nation will receive one sign, and that's the sign of Jonah, the sign of resurrection. It will come on four occasions. This is occasion number one. And the Sanhedrin realizes what's going on, and we learn that at this point the official rejection of Yeshua took place. They sought ways to kill him. So Yeshua leaves the Jerusalem-Bethany area, and he goes to the little town of Ephraim, about 15 miles to the north, and ministers there for a short time. We don't know exactly what he did there, but he got out of the immediate range of the Sanhedrin. Then from Ephraim, he went into the no man's land between Samaria, here's Samaria, and Galilee. And you can see there's a little bit of a no man's land between these two territories. So he goes up the main road, and somewhere in this area, he ministers. He teaches, one of the things he taught about was the mystery kingdom. He referred to the mystery kingdom again. And this is the chart that I promised you. I handed it out to you guys. So you have this chart, the five facets of the kingdom of God, in lesson 6, page 6. But I'm just giving you an additional chart. You can stick it in here if you want to for your reference, because the fifth row there deals with the mystery form of the kingdom, the fifth facet of the kingdom of God. So that's what that handout is all about. And remember, we define the mystery kingdom in this manner. Conditions on earth during the king's absence. The king is absent, but he is ruling in the hearts of his followers. So we are in the mystery kingdom right now. When you place your trust in Yeshua, he comes into you in the person of the Holy Spirit and will begin ruling your life. That's the growth process. So he is absent, but ruling in the hearts of his followers. Someday he will be present when the Messianic kingdom is set up. So there's the mystery form of the kingdom. After teaching in the area between Samaria and Galilee, Yeshua then leaves and heads back for Jerusalem through Perea, and then into the Decapolis, and then into Perea again, with his ultimate destination being Jerusalem. In Perea, he gave some teaching about his second coming, and this was section 174. First of all, he taught that when he comes again, everybody will know it. Nobody will have any doubt. It will be as bright and obvious as lightning. And of course, you know, we don't get a lot of lightning around here. But, you know, you go back east, up in upper New York State or whatever, when lightning flashes, boy, everybody knows it. Everybody knows it. And the second coming will be like that. Everybody will be aware that he's on his way. Then he gave a little chronology of the sequence of events. He said before this happens, he needed to be rejected at his first coming. Then the tribulation period would come. And at the end of the tribulation period, the second coming and its subsequent judgments. And then he was asked the question, where, Lord, where is your second coming going to be? And he answered rather cryptically there in verse 37 on the top of page 163. And answering, they said to him, where, Lord? And he said to them, where the body is, there also will the vultures be gathered. Now that statement can only be understood in light of cross-references at this point. So we ran through the cross-references on page 57, the chart on page 57. So let me just run through that real quickly again. By the way, the position I take on the tribulation and the second coming can be found in detail in Dr. Fruchtenbaum's book, The Footsteps of the Messiah. I recommend this very highly. I think this is the best book on prophecy that I've read, and I've read my share of them. And we do have copies of it up here if you're interested in it. But that's where you'll find the details. We're not studying eschatology or Revelation tonight. We're studying the life of Messiah. So you will just get an overview, and you can study the cross-references on your own. And that would be a great thing to do during the month and a half that we're off, right? Of course, right. Bonnie, you didn't answer. I said, right?
Right.
Of course, right. There you go. There. All right. You just retained your A, okay? All right, step one in the campaign of Armageddon. Antichrist armies assemble at Armageddon. I've said that so much I can do it now. I'm not going to try it again. All right, that's the first step. Second step, the Antichrist joins his army. Third step, the destruction of Babylon. Fourth step, the fall of Jerusalem. Fifthly, the tribulation Holocaust begins. The Jewish flight to Basra or Petra. Sixth, the armies of the Antichrist besiege Basra or Petra. Seven, the national regeneration of Israel. Every living Jewish man, woman, and child at the end of the tribulation comes to faith in Yeshua, and we call for him to return, and he answers our call with step number 8, the second coming. He then treads the winepress back to Jerusalem, does a the fighting ends in the Valley of Jehoshaphat, and then number 11, he does a victory ascent up the Mount of Olives. So that's what you got on page 57. Now, we're going to go through the whole spiel again, but this time in maps. And that's what this handout is all about. These are your 11 steps in maps. Okay, so you can follow along in this handout, or you can just direct your attention to the overhead, and we'll go through this whole sequence one more time. Okay, I think I will use my pointer here, my handy dandy laser pointer. Alrighty, there is the Middle East. And we're going to begin then with the first step in the campaign of Armageddon. By the way, the Battle of Armageddon is really a misnomer, because no battle actually takes place at Armageddon. Okay? I didn't hear that, Roger. Okay. The Armageddon is an anglicized version of Har Megiddo. Har Megiddo in Hebrew means the mountain or the hill of Megiddo. So the Antichrist armies will assemble there. Now the Har Megiddo overlooks the Jezreel Valley in Israel. And so the first step is for all nations to send representatives to the Antichrist army, and the staging area will be the Jezreel Valley. No fighting will actually occur in the Jezreel Valley. Just like when we liberated Kuwait, we had a staging area, Saudi Arabia, right? Every army needs a staging area. And so that's what's going to happen at the Jezreel Valley at Armageddon. There will be actually no fighting there. Well, that we don't know, but let me go through this. Israel isn't going to just let them do that if Israel knows they're coming to attack. But you'll see in just a second here. Hang on. All right, so the Antichrist armies will assemble there, and there'll be representatives from every country on the face of the earth, including the United States of America. All nations will come against Jerusalem. All right, now this is the Jezreel Valley from Har-Megiddo. I'm standing on Har-Megiddo, and you can see it's not a huge mountain. It's just a little hill. It's not like Mount Rainier or the Cascades or anything like that. And you can see the Jezreel Valley, which is the staging area, is a huge, flat, fertile valley. This is only about a quarter of it here. So this will be crawling with military equipment as they come in by land, sea, and air. By the way, there's access to the Jezreel Valley by land, sea, and air. So all the armies will assemble here. Now, I am going to take the next picture from the Mount of the Precipice, which is this point right here, right above that scar. That's Nazareth right behind you there. So I'm standing at that point looking back at Har-Megiddo in the next picture. And it's sunset. And Har-Megiddo is right in this location, and behind Har-Megiddo is the Mount Carmel mountain range, which is bigger. But Har-Megiddo is right here, and again, you can see the valley is very large, very flat. It's a great staging area. Now we come to stage two, and this stage concerns Babylon. The city of Babylon will be the religious, political, and economic capital of the world during the tribulation period. It'll be the Antichrist's headquarters for his worldwide government. So step two, the Antichrist joins his troops. So he leaves Babylon and goes to the Jezreel Valley to join the troops. So he's not in Babylon when the next event occurs. Now, many have scoffed at the idea that Babylon would become the Antichrist's capital during the tribulation. Oh, Babylon's been destroyed. It'll never be rebuilt again. Sorry, Babylon has never been destroyed, in the manner that the Bible demands. The Bible demands that Babylon be destroyed suddenly and completely. Now, Babylon of old had a large Jewish population in it during the first century. That population continued for another few hundred years until Babylon lost its economic viability. Then Babylon just faded out into a ghost town. It's never been destroyed suddenly and completely. And guess what? Saddam Hussein started the rebuilding of Babylon. And here are pictures taken by a Marine who was stationed over there. And you can see the rebuilding of Babylon came to a pause during our invasion of Iraq, but it is underway again. So there are some of the walls being rebuilt on the ancient foundations. And there's some of the interior picture. There is, again, part of Babylon being rebuilt. So it's continued along since this was taken in 2003. Now, I'm sure ancient Babylon will be surrounded by a modern city when it becomes the Antichrist's headquarters, but it is rising again from the ashes. Okay, Babylon will be the literal headquarters of the Antichrist during the tribulation period. All right, so that brings us to step three, which is the destruction of Babylon. We learn in Jeremiah 51, verses 27 and 28, that the kingdoms of Ararat, located in this area, the kingdoms of Mini, located in this area, this is the ancient names, of course, the kingdoms of Ashkenaz, by the way, is the Hebrew for Germany. So that's why I put that arrow. Germany's off the map here.
So that's where the Ashkenazi...
That's where the term Ashkenazi comes from, yeah. The kingdoms of Ararat, Mini, and Ashkenaz will bring their armies together and unite with the kingdom of the Medes. And the Medes, of course, in ancient times were located right here. Now, they will not then move to the Jezreel Valley, which is what you would expect, since all the armies are gathering there. Instead, in a surprise attack, these four armies will come against Babylon. And at that moment, Babylon will be destroyed suddenly and completely. And that description is in the book of Revelation. It will, and also in the prophets. It will be destroyed in a manner that the Bible demands. That hasn't happened yet. All right, that's the third step in the campaign of Armageddon. By the way, the reason why I call it the campaign of Armageddon is because it's a 3.5-year campaign. You know, it's not one battle. It's not the Battle of Armageddon. First of all, nothing happens up here in the Jezreel Valley except a staging area, and this whole process takes about 3.5 years. All right, now we come to stage 4, the fall of Jerusalem. You would think that Antichrist would defend his capital city. He's not interested in defending his capital city. He has other interests, and the other interest is the destruction of the Jewish people and of Israel. He is duplicating exactly what Hitler did in World War II. The end of World War II, one of the reasons why the Germans were defeated lies in the fact that Hitler refused to stop sending Jews to the gas chambers. His generals on the Russian front begged him for trains to send material, war material, to the Russian front. He didn't do it. He kept the trains filled with Jews going to Auschwitz and the death camps. And that was one of the reasons Germany was destroyed. He had something other in mind. What he had in mind was his war against the Jews. World War II was really a war against the Jews because it was motivated by Satan. And why Satan? Because God has a covenant with the Jewish people. And if any of the promises of that covenant are destroyed or broken, the Abrahamic covenant cannot be fulfilled, Yeshua cannot come back, and Satan's career is safe. Now, one of the promises is the nation promise. If he can destroy the Jewish people, every one of us, down to the last man and woman and child, he's safe. The national promise can never be fulfilled. That was behind Hitler, and that's behind the Antichrist decision as well. So he will not defend his capital city. Instead, he will direct his armies down to Jerusalem. And there will be a horrendous fight. Oh, you should read the description in the prophets. But that's for a study of the prophets. There'll be a horrendous fight, but Jerusalem will fall. In the middle of the tribulation, Jerusalem will fall to the armies of the Antichrist. This brings us to the next stage, which is the tribulation holocaust begins and the Jewish flight to Basra. This is the middle of the tribulation, the 3.5-year point, where Antichrist takes over the temple, sets himself up as God in the temple. Yes. The temple will be up and running by the middle of the tribulation. We don't know when it'll be rebuilt. It could be rebuilt tomorrow. It just has to be up and running by the middle of the tribulation. Okay? So he will seat himself in the Holy of Holies and claim to be God. And of course, Jesus said, when you see that happens, run to the wilderness. Don't go back to get your coat. And so the Jewish people will flee the land from the Negev, from the Shvela, from Judea, from the Judean mountains. And they will flee to Basra or Petra in Edom. Now, Edom is in southern Jordan today. And we learn from the prophets that Edom will escape the influence of the Antichrist. Don't ask us. It doesn't say why or how. All it says is that Edom will escape. And that's because God always provides a place of refuge for the Jewish people. There will be a place of refuge, even though the Antichrist controls the world, and that place of refuge will be Edom and the city of Basra or Petra. Yes?
Was it Ammon and Moab also?
There's another couple other little nations, too, in this area. Now, why they escape his influence, we don't know, but the key thing is Edom will.
But it's basically Jordan.
Basically Jordan, yeah. Basically Jordan. His whole audience is the world. He wants to be worshipped by the world. Okay, he will attack the false prophet because he wants everything directed to himself. Everything. Okay, so he will set himself up as God. Yeah. And of course, the Jewish people won't accept that. We won't accept that. Now, there's always been a refuge. In fact, one of the greatest refuge that Jesus, the Holy Spirit, has provided for the Jewish people is the USA. This has been one of the best refuge that we have experienced in the last 2,000 years. We have thrived here, and we love the USA, but it's one of those places of refuge that God has provided. There will be another one, southern Jordan or Edom, fifth stage of the campaign of Armageddon. Now, this is the Mount Seir mountain range because Petra or Basra is located in this mountain range. It's a very defensible and inaccessible location. And you can get an idea of what the wilderness is like when you see that picture. Now, this is a Google Earth view of Basra or Petra, and this is the valley in which the city is located. You can see another kind of conventional city to the east. That's Wadi Musa. That's where a lot of hotels are located for the tourists. And then again, this is the valley, Basra or Petra, and you can see the main road going into Basra or Petra here. And right here, it kind of disappears into the mountain range. And look at those shadows, huh? Sharp, sharp mountains, inaccessible mountains. But the reason this road disappears into the mountain here is because the main entrance into Basra or Petra is the Sikh. That is a canyon, a very narrow canyon that winds its way right through the side of the Mount Seir mountain range into Basra or Petra. It's a very, very defensible entrance. You can see that the Sikh in some places narrows down to just a few feet across. You know, three soldiers with enough ammunition could hold off a battalion in that area. You can't get armored vehicles in there. You can barely get camels in there. Okay, very, very defensible. And this was the main entrance into Basra or Petra when it was at the height of its economic glory. So as you go down the Sikh, when you come to the end of it, a building begins to appear. Here's another view of it. And here we come now to the end of the Sikh. We walk out of the Sikh and we're face to face with the treasury. Now look at these people here. Five to 6 feet tall. How tall is that? That's huge. Very impressive. It was designed to be impressive. Why? Because when the caravans came out of the Sikh, that's where they had to pay their taxes. Okay, so it's called the treasury. So they would be awed by the Nabataean's, you know, wonder, and they'd happily fall down and pay their taxes right there for their camel.
Seek and ye shall find.
Yes, right. That's two. That's two, Roger. I wish I had a comeback. All right. Now let's go here. As you get closer to the treasury, it gets more and more impressive. Now let's go inside and turn around. We're looking out of that door. Now this guy here is, you know, 5.5-6 feet tall. So that makes this door 30 feet tall. 30 feet tall. The Nabataeans were impressed by scale. Now what is in view through the door? That's the Sikh. That's the where we just came out of. We just walked through the Mount Seir mountain range and walked into Petra or Basra. All right, now this is an aerial view of the same location. Do you see the treasury? Does anyone see the treasury? Yeah, there it is. Not very impressive from this view, is it? Man's work is not very impressive from God's perspective. So there's the treasury, that tiny little carving in the mountain range. And what are those little dots right there? Well, those are the ants. Those are the tourists. Those are the people. You know, we're just little ants. But they, out of the Sikh, this is the Sikh, and you follow the main road into Petra right there. So again, here's that Google Earth view, and the Sikh is somewhere in here. This may be it right here, and there's that main road into the ruins of Petra. There's an awful lot of archaeology that could be done there. But some has been done, and this is the urn tomb at Basra Petra, all of it carved out of the sandstone cliffs of the Mount Seir mountain range. And here is the Deir, or the monastery. Now look at this guy. Say he's 6 feet tall. You know, that's at least 30 feet there. So all those windows are probably 30 feet high. That's impressive, impressive architecture, isn't it? These guys were no dummies. They had a sense of architecture. They had a sense of design. They were engineers. They were great. Yes, question.
But who built all of this?
The Nabataeans.
Now, who were they?
They were a I think they started out as Bedouin Arabs, but they moved in there and they settled down in Petra and carved out all this city out of the rock. Oh yeah, huge. It was a big economic center at one time. Very, very important at one time. And we're only seeing, I'm only giving you a little snatch of what Petra looks like. But the Romans also spent some time there as well. There's theaters there, there's all kinds of stuff.
It was so defensible. What happened to the city?
It basically lost its economic viability. You know, it was conquered now and again. A very defensible city, but that doesn't mean it was impregnable. And basically, trade routes changed, and it faded out into a ghost town. In fact, it was kind of lost for many, many years, and an archaeologist who disguised himself as an Arab heard about it and went in there. And if he had not disguised himself, he would have been killed by the Bedouins. But then Petra, Basra, was rediscovered, I think maybe 100 years ago. Yes, part of Indiana Jones was filmed at the Treasury. Oh, yeah. Yeah, you've seen it all. But you've only seen a small, small portion of an amazing city. Yes, Carolyn.
Well, what century was the thriving, and how did they see inside these places?
What do you mean, how did they see inside?
I mean, did they have solar lighting coming through?
No, they had big windows. Yeah, they'd have to use fire and things like that. Now, these were like caves. Yeah, they were like very fancy caves. And this, I believe Petra was at its height in the intertestamental period. By the first century, it was beginning to lose its grandeur and glory, but it was still very viable in the first century.
A lot of it was facade.
Yeah, this is basically facade. Yeah, they're just big rooms behind there.
Yeah,
huge rooms. All right, so that's a little glance at Basra or Petra. By the way, the Israelis are fascinated with Basra or Petra. They love to go there. All right, this brings us to stage number 6. The armies of the Antichrist besiege Basra. So Jerusalem falls to the Antichrist, and so he sends his armies in pursuit of the fleeing Jewish people, and he sets up a siege around Basra or Petra. It'll last about 3.5 years. This brings us to the 7th stage. 3.5 years go by, and the Jewish people in Petra, this is probably the most important gathering of Jewish people. We will be still scattered all over the world, but either the spiritual center will be here or the governmental center will be here. This is the most important group of Jewish people. But at the 3 days before the end of the tribulation, every living Jewish man, woman, and child comes to faith in Yeshua. As Romans 11:25-27 says, all Israel shall be saved. And we realize that Yeshua is our Messiah, and we begin to call out to him to return. And that brings us to the 8th stage, the second coming of the Messiah. Yeshua answers our prayer. And the initial point of the second coming is Basra or Petra, where he returns to break the siege, the Antichrist siege of that city. This brings it. Every, yes, that's what Romans 11:25-27 says. All Israel shall be saved. And that's exactly what it means. Every living Jewish person scattered around the world will place their faith in Yeshua at the end of the tribulation period. And that's after 2/3 of the worldwide Jewish community are killed by the Antichrist. Okay? Cindy.
Is this where the 144,000 will be?
No, their ministry will be worldwide. They will probably not be here. They'll probably be worldwide. Because during the tribulation, there's a great evangelistic effort. And I call the 144,000 the 144,000 Jewish Billy Grahams. More Gentiles are won to the Lord through the ministry of the 144,000 than in any other time. Yeah, it's great evangelistic efforts. Yes, question.
How many Jewish people do you think will be in Petra at that time?
Well, I have no idea. All I can tell you is this, that the worldwide Jewish population is about 15 million today, maybe not quite that much. If the tribulation occurred today, 2/3 of the worldwide Jewish population would be killed.
Okay.
That means there'd only be, that'd be 10 million killed. And so 5 million of us would be left. Now, 5 million people aren't going to fit into Petra. So we will still be scattered all over the world. No, they're taking nothing. Yeshua said, leave. When you see the Antichrist take over the temple, don't even go back to get your coat. Get out of there. Yes, the prophets tell us that he will take care of them in Bozrah or Petra. But that's a study of the prophets. And so, you'll get that information in the study of the prophets. Okay, so check your cross references, okay? And you'll find it. Yes.
I heard that the term Bozrah it means the sheep's pen.
Yes, Bozrah means sheepfold. Exactly, sheepfold. Yes, and it's a very appropriate name. But anyway, we're not studying this now. We're giving you an overview of this. So I'm going to move on. All right. Good questions, but we're going to move on. All right. The ninth. Stage in the campaign of Armageddon is the fact that the Messiah then treads the winepress. And I see now I've got a quarter to, so we're going to look at the treading of the winepress after your break. So go ahead and take your break and come back when you hear the shofar. All right, we're underway again, and we're at the ninth. We're at the ninth stage of the campaign of Armageddon. The Messiah treads the winepress. Now, this winepress idea comes from the viticulture, and this illustration shows you all the steps of viticulture. We have the grapes being grown here, and then these ladies are gathering the grapes in these baskets and tossing them into the this large vat where the grapes are then crushed by the workers, and the juice, of course, is released and it flows into a catch tank. That is basically the idea behind the wine press. Now, the wine press idea goes back to the prophets. It's not something that was thought up in the New Testament. Isaiah, for example, picks up the wine press idea in Isaiah 63:1-6. And you might think that I'm a bit of a sadist, but this is my favorite section of Scripture. Isaiah is ministering in Jerusalem. So he's in Jerusalem, he's looking south, and he sees a magnificent figure approaching. And he asks a question. Who is this who comes from Edom with garments of glowing colors from Bozrah? Do those names strike a bell now? This one who is majestic in his apparel, marching in the greatness of his strength. Very unusual individual. The individual responds, "It is I who speak in righteousness, mighty to save." So who is that?
Yeshua.
That's Yeshua, yeah. That's the messianic person. He's the only one who can say he is righteous and mighty. Isaiah now asks a second question. Why is your apparel red and your garments like the one who treads the winepress? The magnificent figure responds, "I have trodden the wine trough alone, and from the peoples there was no man with me. I also trod them in my anger and trampled them in my wrath, and their lifeblood is sprinkled on my garments, and I stained all my raiment." See the picture there? Of the workers crushing the grapes. And, this is gentle Jesus, meek and mild, right? Now, a lot of people just view Jesus from a one-sided perspective, that he's our buddy, he's our friend, he's gentle Jesus. But that's only a part of the story. He's also a mighty warrior. And this is Jesus in his battle array. "For the day of vengeance was in my heart, and my year of redemption has come. I looked, there was no one to help. I was astonished, there was no one to uphold." See, all nations have come against the Jewish people, everybody. And so his response, "So my own arm brought salvation to me, and my wrath upheld me. I trod down the peoples in my anger, and made them drunk in my wrath, and I poured out their lifeblood on the earth. So the grapes, which are the nations, the armies of the nations of the world, are gathered. They're thrown into the wine press. The workers then crush the grapes. Here's that picture of some grapes being crushed. And when those grapes are fully crushed, you can see the blood of the grapes fills the wine trough and flows out into the catch tank. No. Now, this is the Nazareth village, and it's a first century village in Galilee, and this is the wine press. Here is the area, the flat area, where the grapes are all stacked up and where the workers crush the grapes. Here is the catch tank. Our guide is standing in the catch tank, and between the two of them, there's a trough that guides the juice into the catch tank. And you can't see that very well, but here's a close-up of that trough. Here's the area where the grapes are crushed. Here is the catch tank down here. Now, this whole idea is then picked up in the New Testament in Revelation 14:20. And the wine press was trodden outside the city, and the city there would be Jerusalem, and the blood came out of the wine press up to the horses' bridles. So that's deep. That's this high, you guys. In some areas, the blood will be about 5 feet deep. For a distance of, and here we come to a sticky point, the NASB and the Amplified say 200 miles. The New Living Translation says 180 miles. The NIV, the RSV, the ESV, and the Amplified all say 1,600 stadia. And the King James Version, the ASV, and the New King James says 1,600 furlongs. Now, the reason for all those translations lays in the fact we don't know exactly the distance there, but, you know, 200 to 180 miles is about right. So I don't know why those translations had to use terminology that we're not familiar with. At least the NASB, the Amplified, and the New Living Translation used miles. Now, this has generated 12 interpretations of the wine press. 12 of them. I'm going to run through them quickly for you. The wine press interpretations. One, the Expositor's Bible Commentary, a good, solid commentary. Hyperbole only. In other words, exaggeration for effect. Any other position is speculation. So that's kind of a weak position. Number two, the Bible Knowledge Commentary is not so, they don't know. Is this literal? It may designate the area of judgment around the city of Jerusalem. So they're pretty tentative. Thirdly, this is the Believer Study Bible. The site of the carnage extends approximately 200 miles. So that's nice and vague. Fourthly, Matthew Poole, an older commentator. In so difficult a business, nothing can be positively determined. So he walks away from it entirely. And he doesn't want to touch it. Fifthly, the King James Bible Commentary, the distance from Basra to Megiddo. Ah, so here we see somebody who takes a position from Basra to Megiddo, or Harmageddon. Sixthly, Albert Barnes, the 200 miles square, a lake of blood, 200 miles by 200 miles by 200 miles. I'm sorry, that's a little bit of an extreme position to take. Seven, MacArthur Study Bible, the approximate distance from Armageddon in the north to Edom in the south. So at least he takes a fairly decent position. Eighth, the distance itself covers the length of Palestine, but it is more likely a metaphor is worked out with the exuberance of apocalyptic symbolism for the whole earth. So this is just some prophet, you know, going out of his gourd and being enthusiastic about his symbolism. So this is a weak position. A.T. Robertson and Sweet. The Ryrie Study Bible. The blood from the slaughter will flow from Armageddon, 180 miles, an enormous river of blood. And 10th, this is John Gill. He's an older commentator. Perhaps there may be an allusion to the measure of the land of Israel and the common notion of it among the Jews who make it to be a square of 400 parsecs. So he again looks at this 200-mile square lake idea. 11th, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown really get allegorical. 1600 is a square number. 4 by 4 by 1 by 100. The four quarters, north, south, east, west of the Holy Land, or else of the world, the completeness and universality of the worldwide destruction being hereby indicated. So they say this is totally symbolic. Totally symbolic. Number 12, even Dr. Fruchtenbaum. The 200 miles may refer to the entire area from the Valley of Armageddon to Basra, which is about 200 miles. Another possible explanation is that it refers to a round trip distance between Jerusalem and Basra. All right, I even disagree with Dr. Fruchtenbaum. I don't accept any of these positions. They all seem extremely weak to me. So, if there are 12 opinions, I will share with you number 13. My opinion. All right, take it or leave it. This is my opinion, okay? I'm not happy with any of those. All right, let's take a look at the distance involved to see if we can solve this problem. If we draw some lines from the Jezreel Valley to Basra, yes, we can get a distance of about 180 miles to 200 miles. We can get that. But there's a problem with this. And the problem lies in the fact that the wine press does not go past Jerusalem. Okay? Yeshua treads the wine press to Jerusalem and does a victory ascent up the Mount of Olives. Okay? So you can't count all that stuff up there. All right, so what happens if you draw a line from Jerusalem to Basra, Petra, in a straight line? You get only about 140 miles. So that doesn't solve the problem. How do we solve the problem? We solve the problem with more biblical data. All right, first of all, Habakkuk 3:3. God comes from Teman, the Holy One from Mount Paran, Selah. His splendor covers the heavens, and the earth is full of his praise. Sounds like the second coming to me, doesn't it? So we have Teman and Mount Paran. We need a Teman and we need a Mount Paran, okay? Where is Teman? Well, there are three possible locations for Teman. We're not sure, but they're all around Basra. One to the north, one to the east, one to the south. Three possible locations. I will choose the southern location because it works well, but we don't really know where Teman is located. What about Mount Paran? Well, the wilderness of Paran is right down here. So Mount Paran is in this location. All right, so we've accounted now for the second coming and two locations, right? All right, let's add some more data. Joel 2:20. Again, the context is the second coming. But I will remove the northern army far from you, and I will drive it into a parched and desolate land. So we need a northern army. Do we have a northern army? Yes, the Antichrist army is coming from the north, from Armageddon down to Jerusalem, and from Jerusalem down to Basra. We have a northern army. Do we have a parched and desolate land? We need that. He goes on, Joel goes on. And its vanguard, God says, I will push into the eastern sea, and its rear guard into the western sea. And its stench will arise, and a foul smell will come up, for it has done great things. Again, sounds like the second coming, doesn't it? Crushing of the wine of the grapes. So now we need an eastern sea and a western sea. Do we have this? Well, we do have a parched and desolate land right there. It's called the Negev. Is that parched and desolate, or is that parched and desolate? If you've been to the Negev, you know it's parched and desolate. There's the Wadi Zin. All right, so we have a parched and desolate land in the vicinity. All right, do we have an eastern sea? Well, we've got two options here. We have a northern eastern sea, which is the Dead Sea, or it could be a southern eastern sea, which is the Red Sea, the Gulf of Eilat coming up here. So we got two options for an eastern sea. Do we have a western sea? We sure do, right there, the Mediterranean. So as we bring all that information together from Joel 2:20, we probably have the field of battle. I think this is probably the field of battle for the final stage of the campaign of Armageddon. All right, so what happens? Yeshua responds to the cry of Israel. He returns to save his people at Basra. Then the next stage is that he winds his way or makes his way to Teman. Why would he go to Teman? Well, it just strikes me that this particular verse could answer that question for us. 2 Thessalonians 2:8. Then the lawless one, a reference to the Antichrist, will be revealed, whom the Lord will do what? He will slay with the breath of his mouth and bring to an end by the appearance of his coming. So the Antichrist is going to be one of the first, if not the first casualty of the second coming. And I have a feeling that his military headquarters will be Taman. That's my guess. That's my guess as to why God would come from Taman. I think he goes after the Antichrist first. From that point, he then continues to tread the winepress down into the wilderness of Paran. God has to come from Mount Paran, correct? And as he does that, he can push the vanguard of the Antichrist armies into the Eastern Sea. That fits, doesn't it? It fits. All right, he continues through the parched and desolate land. And as he does, he could very easily be pushing the remnants of the Antichrist army into the Western Sea as he goes in that direction. He could also push the remaining part of the army into the Dead Sea, which would be our other choice for an Eastern Sea, and then finish up at Jerusalem. Now, if the wine press looks like that, it's easy to get 180 to 200 miles, isn't it? We just have to reject the idea that this has to be straight lines. Okay? This could very easily be 100 to 280 miles. Yeah, blood the whole way, because he's crushing the army. Doesn't say everywhere. In some portions, some areas, the blood will be 5 feet deep.
I'm sitting here thinking, how many quarts of blood in a person? That's how many people yeah. shows up that
All right, okay. We'll leave that up to the Lord, okay? In some places, the blood will be 5 feet deep, but I don't think it has to be every place, okay? Yes. Yeah, the eastern entrance is the main entrance, but you can get into Basra from the north and the south and the west. It's not easy, but you can get in that way. No, no, no. Yeshua will come from up above, and then he'll probably take that eastern entrance, and he could go to the eastern Taman, or he could just come down to the southern Taman. Okay, he could go right out the Sick, which would be a perfect example of a. Well, I'm not going to tell you that verse. You're going to have to study the prophets. It says the breaker will go forth before them. He will break open the way, and it's a picture of leaving Basra, leaving a sheepfold through the main entrance to the sheepfold. Okay, it's a perfect picture of a sheepfold. That's what Basra means, a sheepfold. So I think Yeshua will tread out the Sikh myself. Alrighty, so the Messiah has now tread the winepress back to Jerusalem.
Alone.
Yeah, he does all the fighting. We come back with him, but we minister to the Jewish people in Basra or Petra. Don't worry, you won't be part of the fighting, guys. He doesn't need you. He will do this all alone. Okay? He will do this all alone. It's spectacular, yes. Read it in the prophets.
I did.
Yeah, it's spectacular. Yeah. All righty, the fighting will end in the Valley of Jehoshaphat. Now, this is the Kidron. Some people feel that this is the Valley of Jehoshaphat. I do not think that that is a good choice. I will show you an alternative position. But I do think Yeshua will tread the winepress up through the Kidron Valley because he has to get to the base of the Mount of Olives. All right, now, here is the Kidron Valley. I'm standing just south of the Temple Mount, looking to the south, and you can see the valley going off, descending before me. This is the Arab village of Silwan on the eastern side of the Kidron Valley. Now, I've dialed in my telephoto a little longer, and you can see the end of the valley as it curves down here. Again, this is the Arab village of Silwan. That's the way the valley looks today. Now, we've come down from the Temple Mount. And we're looking north now in the other direction. Now, to the north, you can see the corner of the Temple Mount showing up. And this is the Mount of Olives. And, of course, in between, this is the Valley of the Kidron. And, again, this is the Arab village of Silwan on the right. So, again, that's the way it looks today. I'm on the Mount of Olives at this picture. Again, looking down the Kidron Valley. And in the foreground, you can see a huge Jewish graveyard. When you walk into the graveyard, this is what you see. Jewish people have been buried there for years because they're expecting the Messiah to come to the Mount of Olives, and they want to be resurrected right there when he's there. So these are Jewish people that believe in the coming of the Messiah. Or these are where their final resting places are. Huge Jewish graveyard there. Now this is looking at where the Kidron Valley joins the Hinnom Valley. This is the Hinnom Valley here, the Kidron Valley here. This is the very end of Mount Zion, the southern tip of Mount Zion. And finally, another view of the Kidron in front of us here with the Temple Mount in the background and West Jerusalem beyond that. Again, we're on the Mount of Olives looking west here. Here is the Kidron Valley in the foreground.
Hang on.
Now, in Zechariah 14, verses 4 and 5, we read that in that day his feet, speaking of the messianic person, his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives, which is in front of Jerusalem on the east. So Yeshua has to get on the Mount of Olives some way. And the Mount of Olives will be split in its middle from east to west by a very large valley, so that half the mountain will move to the north, the other half toward the south. All right, now how do you integrate this data? Well, I think that, let me finish up Zechariah 14. And you will flee by the valley of my mountains, for the valley of the mountains will reach to Azel. So we learn here that the Mount of Olives is going to be split east and west so that the part of it moves north and part of it moves south, creating a valley. I believe that that valley is the Valley of Jehoshaphat. Because nobody today knows where the Valley of Jehoshaphat is. They guess that it's the Kidron Valley. I think the reason they don't know where it is because it doesn't exist yet. And so I think this valley that's going to be created will be the Valley of Jehoshaphat. Now, how does this... let's finish up Zechariah 14. Yes, you will flee just as you fled before the earthquake in the days of Uzziah of Judah. Then the Lord my God will come, and all his holy ones with him. So there's the messianic person coming, and you and I with him in his train. Now, how is this going to work out? If the Kidron is the Valley of Jehoshaphat, it parallels the Mount of Olives. And so it's not going to be part of splitting the Mount of Olives in half. Now, here is a Google Earth view of the territory. Here is the Temple Mount. Can you see that okay? There's the Temple Mount, the Dome of the Rock. This is the Mount of Olives right here, and this is the Kidron Valley. What we need is some kind of an earthquake fault running east and west into the Mount of Olives. And guess what? Zechariah is perfectly accurate. There it is. That is the earthquake fault running into the Mount of Olives. Now, I am standing here at this viewpoint, and I'm aiming my camera across the road there down at the earthquake fault. All right, here it is. Now, this is what I believe is the, and I'm not the only one who holds this position, you guys, so I'm not totally out to lunch on this. This is what I believe is the alternate location for the Valley of Jehoshaphat. And this is the earthquake fault right there. You can see it nice and straight. Very typical earthquake fault. Now I'm going to back off with my camera, and we're going to back off a ways. And again, here is the earthquake fault. You can see the Mount of Olives coming up here. This is part of the Mount of Olives off on the right. Now I'm going to zero in on this area with my trusty little camera. And again, here's the Mount of Olives on the right. And there is the earthquake fault running into the Mount of Olives. So those people have built their houses in a very precarious place. So someday I think that fault is going to be ruptured. It'll create a great valley. The northern part of the Mount of Olives, where we're standing right here, will move to the north, and the southern part of the Mount of Olives, which is over there, will move south, and this valley will be in between. And the Jewish people holed up on the Temple Mount will flee from the Temple Mount through that valley to safety. So I believe that is the Valley of Jehoshaphat. Now, I said earthquake faults are rather straight in nature. That's a characteristic of an earthquake fault, and this is the San Andreas fault. Look how straight it is. Now, it's a lot bigger fault than the one we're looking at Jerusalem, but the characteristics are the same. So around here, when you see a straight little valley, don't go there.
Whose fault is that?
Whose fault is that? I warned you. That's about number five. All right. So we come to the 11th stage of the campaign of Armageddon, which is the victory ascent up the Mount of Olives. Yeshua is located at the base of the Mount of Olives here, and so he makes a victory ascent either up the northern or southern side of the Mount of Olives, and our campaign of Armageddon comes to a close. Now, I've gone through that whole big spiel simply because the disciples asked a question. Lord, where is the second coming going to be? And this is the point I want to make. The initial point of the second coming will be Basra or Petra. That's the answer to the question. And using the symbolism that Yeshua uttered, the cryptic answer, we're now at point 5 on page 56. The body, the corpse then, is Israel. The vultures are the Gentile armies. And during the second coming, the body of Israel is in the land of Edom, in the city of Petra or Basra. And where the body is, the vultures, the Gentile armies, will gather. And so the initial point of the second coming is going to be very, very obvious. It's going to be as obvious as when vultures circle the location of a corpse, right? That's a classic view, right? You see the vulture circling, you know the corpse is below. It's going to be that obvious. Yes?
Will the United States be in the vulture
too? Yes, the United States will give its contribution to the armies. All nations will come against Jerusalem. It's already starting. Yes? No, I think it's just slightly south of the temple.
South?
Yeah, as it comes through the Mount of Olives, I think it's just slightly south of the temple. All righty. All right, now I've just given you a quick overview, and I know you're all mad at me for that, so don't throw your rotten tomatoes at me. A detailed view of this study would be found in a study of the prophets or a study of eschatology. So you're going to have to wait till that class comes around for any details. All righty, let's move on. We've answered the question that the disciples asked in a rather detailed way. So now turn to page 58, and we'll come to section 175. In your outline, two parables on prayer: the importunate widow and the Pharisees and the publican. So we're going to start here in verses 1 through 8. This is on page 163 of your Harmony, section 175. And we begin with a lesson in perpetual prayer on verses 1 through 8. Everybody get there? Everybody there okay? Now he was telling them a parable to show that at all times they ought to pray and not lose heart, saying, There was in a certain city a judge who did not fear God and did not respect man. And there was a widow in that city, and she kept coming to him, saying, "Give me legal protection from my opponent." And for a while he was unwilling. But afterward he said to himself, "Even though I do not fear God or respect man, yet because this widow bothers me, I will give her legal protection, lest by continually coming, she wear me out." And the Lord said, "Hear what the unrighteous judge said. Now, shall not God bring about justice for his elect, who cry to him day and night? And will he delay long over them? I tell you that he will bring about justice for them speedily. However, when the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on the earth?" So this is a parable about perpetual prayer. Never give up. I am very tempted to give up praying. I don't know about you guys. But this paragraph is especially important in light of the previous paragraph dealing with the second coming. Israel has to keep on praying and never give up. So just like that unrighteous judge responds because of persistence, and this is a Kalva Homer argument from the minor to the major, how much more is God willing to respond to his people who are righteous? So the certainty of things to come is our motivation for our prayers. Now, we can count on an event happening if our prayers are in line with the will of God. That's the key. If our prayers line up with the will of God, it will happen. Now, this is not a detailed explanation of prayer. There's much more that could be said, but that's what we learn here. Perpetual prayer. Never give up. Be like that widow. The next lesson, lesson 2, deals with humble prayer in verses 9 and 10. He also told this parable to certain ones who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and viewed others with contempt. Two men went up to the temple, into the temple to pray, one a Pharisee, the other a tax gatherer. So two people are praying. Here's an illustration. And in this illustration, the Pharisee looks quite confident, doesn't he? He's confident that he is righteous, and he trusts in himself. And in the background there is the tax collector. Now, the Pharisee prays to show off his righteousness, verses 11 and 12. The Pharisee stood and was praying thus to himself, God, I thank thee that I am not like other people, swindlers, unjust, adulterers, or even like this tax gatherer. I fast twice a week. I pay tithes of all I get. Now, he mentions fasting twice a week. A Pharisaic fast days were Monday and Thursday, which was much more than required by the Mosaic Law. The Mosaic Law doesn't really require you to fast except perhaps on Yom Kippur. But these guys fasted twice a week, and they tithed everything possible. So our Pharisee friend here in the illustration is thinking, God is sure lucky to have me on his side. Question?
The way that's phrased there, the Pharisee stood and was praying thus to himself.
To himself, yeah. Yeah.
God.
The implication is that God is not hearing him.
Here I am,
yeah.
God.
Yeah.
No,
he's not calling himself God. No Pharisee would do that, okay? But the implication there is he's not praying to God. He's praying to himself.
Right.
You know, that's it. But he thinks he's praying to God.
Okay.
He thinks he's addressing God, okay? All right. Verse 13. But the tax gatherer, standing some distance away, was even unwilling to lift up his eyes to heaven, but was beating his breast, saying, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. All right, now the Pharisee felt God was sure lucky to have him on his side, and I can give you a similar statement from the Talmud. This comes from Maaseh Berachot 28b. This is a Pharisaic prayer. I give thanks to thee, O Lord my God, that thou hast set my portion with those who sit in the Beit HaMidrash, in the school. And thou hast not set my portion with those who sit in the street corners. For I rise early, and they rise early. But I rise early for words of Torah, and they rise early for frivolous talk. I labor, and they labor. But I labor to receive a reward, and they labor and do not receive a reward. I run, and they run. But I run to the life of the future world, and they run to the pit of destruction. So this Pharisee, as he looks at the tax collector, would think, well, that guy's going to the pit of destruction. But the publican is saying, be merciful to me, a sinner. Now, that word merciful means to be propitiated. Now, we don't use that word so much in English today, but it just means to be appeased. Basically, the tax collector is praying, Oh God, be appeased in regard to my sin. Be satisfied in regard to my sin. Forgive my sin. Now, this is very appropriate for the tax collector to pray, but it's not an appropriate prayer for a New Testament believer, because with the death of Messiah, our sins have been propitiated. Our sins have been appeased. All we have to do is confess, 1 John 1:9. But in the Old Testament, under the Old Testament dispensation, it's this publican who went home justified and not the Pharisee. And he went home justified because of his humble faith. And in verse 14, we come across that theme we've been dealing with for the last few weeks. Verse 14, I tell you, this man went down to his house justified rather than the other. For everyone who exalts himself shall be humbled, and he who humbles himself shall be exalted. It's another way of saying the first will be last, and the last will be first. All right, so this brings us now to page 59 and section 176, but we're going to have to take up that section next year. Okay, we're out of time for this study. So let me go ahead and pray. I apologize for keeping you 5 minutes over, but let me pray, and then I'll turn you loose.
That's from all of us.
Oh, well, thank you. Well, I appreciate your gift here. Thank you, guys. I see a card here. Okay. That'll come. We'll take care of that after class. Okay, thank you very much. All right, let me pray. Let me pray, and then I'll turn you loose. Father, again, thank you for what you have brought before us today. From the campaign of Armageddon, we know whose side we're on. We know who gets the victory. We know where this world is going. And that should relieve a lot of fear in our hearts. So we're grateful for prophecy and for laying out the future for us. But you know, Lord, that could make us proud, and we could become just like that Pharisee, looking down on those who are not believers and proudly thinking where they're going to the pit of destruction. Lord, help us never to take on that attitude, but instead to take on the attitude of the tax collector. I am a sinner. Thank you for forgiving my sin. And help us to reach out to those who are heading to the pit of destruction, and we can be your life preserver to bring the message of the gospel to them. Help us to view our family, our coworkers, the guy that cuts us off on the freeway. Help us to view everyone in that light, that we have the message of eternal life, and we need to get it out to the entire world, to the Jew first, before the end comes. We need your help to do that, Lord, and we ask for it in Yeshua's name. And we thank you in his name. Amen. All right, so we'll see you guys next year.